Welcome to the Monday of Thanksgiving Week edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we have a thought-provoking lineup for you today. Later in the show, we'll explore the cutting edge of clean energy with Ben Holson, solar and renewable specialist, as we discuss the power of the sun, the rise of electric vehicles, and what it all means for our state. But first, we turn our focus to the global stage with Dr. Thomas Ambrosio, professor of political science at North Dakota State University. As tensions escalate between the United States and Russia, we'll tackle a critical question. Is Russia bringing us closer to a direct conflict than we've seen in decades? And why does this matter to us here in North Dakota? Dr. Ambrosio, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we've had an election.
Yes.
We'll have a new administration. We'll have a House now that is all controlled by Republicans. And we continue to have this war in Ukraine. A lot will change now. What do you think?
Well, I think the war in Ukraine right now is coming to at least a pause or a conclusion, maybe not a capital C conclusion, but maybe a little c, lowercase conclusion, in the sense that both sides at this point are kind of exhausted. The Ukrainians in particular, they're losing ground on every front right now that they're currently fighting. Neither side can achieve its maximal goals. So Russia's goal initially was to take all of Ukraine and make it essentially a puppet state. And they realized very quickly they could not do that. And by the summer of 22, you know, after the war started, Ukrainians are a little slower to come to that realization. For them, the maximal goals is kicking Russia out of all their land, which is not going to happen, never going to happen. Anyone who thinks differently doesn't really see what's going on the battlefield. There's going to be a negotiated settlement. Now, for the first time in a Gallup poll, the Ukrainian people, a slim majority, but 52% now say we need to move towards a negotiation. So what we're seeing now, I think, on the battlefield is part of that negotiation process.
I wondered what a soldier, a Ukrainian soldier in a foxhole, thought about on election night. We talked about that briefly before we came on microphone. He told me the average age of a soldier in Ukraine is 41.
Yeah, it's in the low 40s. So what the Ukrainians have done is they have not actually drafted their kind of 18 to 25-year-olds because they know that there's going to be a lot of bodies thrown at the Russian problem and a lot of people are going to die. Ukrainians have been very kind of hidden about how much they've taken in casualties. So they want to, for demographic reasons, keep their youngest generation, the youngest people. So what we've seen actually is older men being drafted. Imagine being a soldier in your 40s in a foxhole. There's not a great surprise that the war starting to come to a conclusion because, again, neither side, especially the Ukrainians, realize they cannot fully win this war in terms of reclaiming all their land. And that there will have to be some kind of negotiated settlement. So I think there's still a lot of support, obviously, in Ukraine to keep Ukraine independent. And Ukraine has secured its independence. That is a win for Ukraine. And they have solidified their society around that goal and that identity. But now we're talking about simply where the borders get drawn, either in terms of what the official borders will be or some kind of ceasefire borders. The question then becomes, how many lives are we willing to expend to get another 100 square miles for the biggest land country in Europe, excluding Russia? At some point, the war needs to come to an end. And I think we're going to see that end coming sooner rather than later.
And you say that pretty confidently. I want to ask you that question in the context of what I read in the New York Times just today. Here's the quote. Mr. Putin is bringing Russia closer to a direct conflict with the United States than at any point in decades. And I ask that with the news that Russia has now provided air defense systems to North Korea. North Korea, of course, is providing soldiers to Russia. Is this going to end as quickly as you're hopeful that it may?
I think it will. So, of course, the Russians would respond by saying the United States has brought war closest, or the two countries closest to the brink of war since the end of the Cold War. So both sides right now are playing this game of escalation. Now, there's a real fear, on especially on the American side, that somehow we're going to cross some red line and then it's going to go nuclear, which, of course, is everyone loses at that point. So I think what we're seeing now is an escalation in order to set the table on the battlefield, which in turn sets the table for the negotiation process. The launch of the hypersonic missile by Russia, in many ways, was a signal to the United States that we had crossed a red line.
By using the longer range
missile to strike Russia proper, which doesn't change the battlefield fundamentally, but for Russia, it really is kind of this mental line that they would argue the United States has crossed. That's, I think, what's happening here, is that both sides are kind of escalating in order to be in a better bargaining position for later.
How will their claim to winning impact the rest of the world?
Well, if they're able to succeed, it certainly changes the dynamics within in Europe, that Russia was able to basically get away with an act, a bold-faced act of aggression. I doubt they're going to be able to have their territorial claims officially recognized, like legally. In some ways, not losing means they won. And Ukraine itself is of course, damaged. Ukraine itself is going to be in a relatively weaker position, possibly. Russia can kind of come to the table of the world and say, we succeeded in many ways.
In 1991, when Ukraine gained its independence with the downfall and the dissolution of the Soviet Union, did you see this coming? Did you see this day on the horizon way back then?
Not exactly. There's a lot of people in Russia who never quite accepted the fact of Ukraine being a separate country. However, Russia and Ukraine have actually had relatively good relations in the 1990s. They had the Orange Revolution in 2004, which created some tensions between Russia and Ukraine. But even after that, Russia and Ukraine kind of got along okay. And even the government in Ukraine leading up to the Maidan Revolution in 2014 was actually quite positive towards Russia. But Russia looked to the West and they saw a particular problem. And the problem in many ways was NATO expansion. They looked at this enemy alliance that they had stood up against for two generations, and they see it creeping towards them. And then in 2008, when the United States said that, and NATO said that we would allow Georgia and Ukraine into NATO, that was a line that was crossed that the Russians were very upset about. Now, that's kind of the strategic geopolitical answer. The other answer is this: there's many Russians who do not see Ukraine as a separate country. They see it as the heart of their civilization, kind of where it began in Kievan Rus. And there has always been this notion within the Russian national identity of being the big brother to the other two little Russias, Ukraine and Belarus, and that Russia must gather its lands. And prior to the war, the full invasion, in June of 2021, Vladimir Putin released this love letter to Ukraine, this document, which talked about the historic unity of Ukrainians and Russians, which said that Ukraine isn't a real country. In fact, that's something that he had supposedly said to George W. Bush back in the day. At that point, the writing was kind of on the wall. You mix in the geopolitics along with the national identity, and it makes sense that Russia would invade.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Thomas Ambrosio. He's a professor of political science at North Dakota State University. He's currently the advisor for the department's pre-law program, and his research interests include Ludic studies, international relations, Russian foreign policy, and the stability of authoritarian regimes. What about NATO? This doesn't preclude now, in the conclusion that you are suggesting, that an independent Ukraine couldn't still pursue a NATO relationship. What are your thoughts about that?
Ukraine now wants to join NATO, and for good reason, because they want that protection by the United States, formal protection. Whether or not Ukraine is allowed into NATO will be kind of a two-pronged process. The first is whether or not Ukrainian neutrality is enshrined in any agreement to end the war. The other one would be if Ukraine could even be allowed in, because you would need unanimity amongst all the members of NATO to allow Ukraine in. And it's unlikely, certainly at this point, that you would be able to get that.
So I would even wonder if the United States would support that with the new administration. Have you thought about that?
Under the new administration, probably not. Probably not, because you're essentially, especially if you don't have a formal end of the war in terms of where there's a legal transfer of territory and there's new formal boundaries, if you just have some ceasefire, you're essentially importing this problem, this disputed territory, into NATO. And one thing NATO has done since it started expanding in the 1990s is to say that in order to join, all of your territorial issues must be resolved. And if things are not fully resolved with Russia, then it's unlikely that it would ever really get passed in the United States.
If this war is resolved, is Russia done trying to be a strong man and going after anything else in the region?
This may be, depending on how the war gets resolved, maybe simply round one of future wars. Nothing really truly ever ends, so we might see something in the future. If things develop in Belarus, in which Russia feels its security interests are questioned, it will do what it needs to do in order to secure Belarus, which is essentially a Russian puppet right now anyway, but is still nominally independent. I think that's as far as it's going to go. For the main reason that, you know, I was just in Estonia. I was talking to different groups, high school students, college students, some their school diplomacy. And the big issue for them was, if the war in Ukraine gets resolved, are they going to come for us? But Estonia and the other Baltic countries and, you know, Finland now has something that Ukraine never had, which is a sign that says this country protected by the United States. And that's has been something that's always stopped Russia. The Russians historically have never gone after a superior power. They've never attacked a superior power. They've always gone after weaker powers or weaker areas. And usually they back down when they're really confronted. So I don't see them ever going into the Baltics. Unless the United States maybe withdrew from NATO or something like that, which is unlikely to ever happen.
You talk about the war in Ukraine with your students at North Dakota State University. Are they interested in it? And why would they be interested in it? And for that matter, why should anyone in North Dakota pay attention to the war in Ukraine?
Well, certainly when the war started, my international politics class was going on at the time, and we basically stopped everything. All the lesson plans went out the window, and we talked about it. Students were really fascinated by it because it was the first war that they really were able to witness unfolding in real time. So they certainly were interested in it. Why is it important for North Dakota? Well, it's important for several reasons. One, you could just say basic economics in terms of wheat production and things of that, kind of agricultural production. If the war ends, then you'll have a lot more wheat on the market. But beyond that, this is a source of potential security threat for the United States. The real fear of escalation is there when we are in an open proxy war with Russia. So that matters to everyone. And that's one thing that's kind of stayed the Biden administration's hand in terms of giving full-throated support to Ukraine is this fear of escalation, that things could go, well, nuclear, and no one wants that. Also, in terms of effects in general, it's been costing the United States a lot of money. So a lot of money has gone to Ukraine, and even when the war is over, we'll probably be giving Ukraine a lot more money for reconstruction.
Has that money been well spent?
Depends on how you want to look at it.
How do you look at it?
If you want to look at the cold-blooded, pure geopolitics, absolutely it's been well spent. We've gotten Russia bogged down into a war in which it's lost maybe 150,000 soldiers plus a couple hundred other thousand soldiers wounded. It has really damaged their economy with no cost of American lives. And yes, it's cost us many billions of dollars. But in the grand scheme of things, it cost the Russians more. So if you want to play that pure great power game, that's fine. And therefore, it's been cost effective at the cost of Ukrainian lives. But that might be acceptable for some people. If you want to look at it through the lens of kind of the military industrial complex, it's been great because everything we've given to Ukraine or everything that our allies have given to Ukraine, we have replaced. So it's been a boon for the military manufacturers. It's also, but there's also another hand to it, which is this is a lot of money. And what have we gotten for it when all said and done? And then also, what could we have gotten earlier? And this is one of the stories that kind of needs to be that will be written eventually. There are a lot of reports that a peace deal could have been achieved early on in this war by the summer. And if we wind up in the same spot that we would have gotten to back then, all that money, all those lives kind of were wasted.
What got in the way of that happening last summer?
Again, it depends on who you ask, but a lot of people put blame on the British and the Americans that we're not willing to accept a peace deal. We did not want Ukraine to achieve peace. Now, again, you can make an argument that if they did have a peace, it would only be temporary, then Russia would go in again, because Russia has not been exhausted by the war as they are now. So therefore, now, after almost 3 years of fighting, a real peace possibly may be in the offing. But we don't know. That's one of the big unanswered questions of this war.
What should we be looking for relative to a potential peace deal? How do you think that will manifest?
You're going to initially see, and you're already starting to see, some shift in rhetoric by the Ukrainian government, where there's going to be increasing talk about not victory with a capital V, but how do we get the best deal we can? We already started to see that. And in many ways, the Ukrainian invasion into Russia, into the Kursk region of Russia and occupying that, that was part of the negotiation process. If we think about war is diplomacy by other means. And that was part of it. That was a bargaining chip to give away for something in return. The problem for the Ukrainians right now is that actually they're losing in the Kursk region. And they probably will lose that over the next couple of months. And then that gives away their biggest bargaining chip. But I think just the first, you'll see the rhetoric. I think once the Trump administration comes into office, you're going to see things really accelerate.
Do you think that would have also accelerated had President Trump lost the election?
I don't know what's going on in the Biden administration. I'm not sure what was going on in the Harris campaign. But my gut tells me yes. Because there has to be an understanding, because you can look at the battlefield and you can see the Ukrainians are losing. You're about to have the intervention possibly of 10,000 North Korean troops on the ground going in and helping Russia restore its control over the Kursk region. And they have to understand that the war is not going well. And having some long-range missiles or giving more weapons is not going to fundamentally change the dynamics. The Ukrainians are running out of people. The Russians are too, but they're running out of people at a much slower rate. And the Russians have been able to continue its military campaign despite the sanctions.
You would ask the man on the street or the woman on the street in Russia, generally speaking, has this been good for their country? Do we know?
We don't know, and it really depends on which region you're talking about. So if you're in Moscow or St. Petersburg, you're probably like, everything's fine. Largely because those are the two power centers of Russia, and the Kremlin did not really draft heavily from those areas. If you are in, especially the minority regions of Russia, and Russia has about 20% non-ethnic Russians, it's been devastating. They've lost an entire generation. And the economy, they've had inflation, the economy has declined. A much larger part of their budget is now devoted to military. So yeah, they've been hurt by it. But that's a financial cost. But if you ask the Russians, was it worth it to stop NATO from going into Ukraine or to, quote unquote, save the Russians in eastern Ukraine and Crimea as the Russians have framed it, though they were not as much under threat as the Russians framed it, they might say yes.
I know military history isn't your bailiwick, so to speak, but in your analysis of what's happened, will future wars be different?
Absolutely. The war in Ukraine has fundamentally changed the nature of warfare. So there actually was an earlier war between Azerbaijan and Armenia just a few years ago, which gave us the signal for what we're seeing now, which is the widespread use of unmanned aerial vehicles. And that's fundamentally changed the battlefield. It's very difficult to get surprise on the battlefield now because you have all these UAVs. Offense may not have the advantage anymore in terms of airplanes, in terms of tanks and things of that nature. In fact, what we've seen in Ukraine is a reversion to a very much older style of warfare, like World War I and trench warfare.
That surprised me, and I'm not a connoisseur of war history either. But in today's world, yes, that was surprising to me.
It's surprising, and it's directly connected to the UAVs. So it's hard to do an offensive in modern warfare because you have eyes everywhere. You have very cheap weapon systems, basically drones. You could drop a grenade on an individual, and it's hard to advance out of your trenches. And if that's the case, you have kind of these stalemates, and the only way to change the calculus on the battlefield is to throw bodies at things, something we have not really seen for a long time. So there is a tremendous amount of data that military planners are getting out of Ukraine. And we'll have to see how it really shifts. And one of the big questions is the tank dead? We'll see. We'll see. But certainly warfare looks different now than it did 5 years ago.
Next year, just before Thanksgiving, what will you be telling your international studies students about this war, do you think?
My belief is the war will be in a pause or a ceasefire or maybe even something more permanent. And this will be when in my international politics class, we actually have a whole section about modern international politics and focus on Russia for like a week and a half and Eastern Europe. And this will be kind of a continuation of this struggle between how Russia sees the world and how we see the world and Russia. And hopefully this will be some kind of a real settlement. But I think when I teach my students about it, it'll be, okay, this war has now shaped the nature of our relationship with the largest land country in the world and one of the great powers that's now completely opposed to the United States.
Dr. Thomas Ambrosio is a professor of political science at North Dakota State University, and he's currently the advisor for the department's pre-law program, and research interests include Russian foreign policy. Dr. Ambrosio, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. Coming after the break, Ben Holson, solar and renewable specialist and owner of Holson Home Automation and Solar. Our conversation is about solar power and EVs right here in North Dakota. That's after this. Support for Prairie Public is provided by the FM Area Foundation, offering the Caring Catalog, December 2nd through the 13th, an online giving platform connecting community members with local nonprofits during the holiday season. Learn more at areafoundation.org. FM Area Foundation, connecting people and purpose. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Womenshine. Our conversation now turns to solar power and electric vehicles with Ben Holson, solar and renewable specialist and owner of Holson Home Automation and Solar. Welcome back to Main Street, Ben.
Thanks for having me again.
I want to cover two topics like we did last time, solar electricity for homes and maybe businesses, and then also the EV industry for electric vehicles.
Sure.
Let's start with the solar industry first. Is North Dakota a good place to have electric power generated from solar panels?
So it's a great place to actually have solar, yes. From an actual generation standpoint, yes, it's a great place for solar energy. We can generate tons and tons of power. It's very underutilized in this state in terms of where we are, in terms of latitude. North Dakota is number 51 in the nation for solar uptake. We are dead last in the nation. Minnesota, which is the same latitude as us, basically the same geography, same climate, they're number 18. What it comes down to is policy and regulations. But North Dakota, you know, is a fantastic place to generate. The one thing is that solar really generates well in the cold. Obviously, we don't have as long of hours. Solar panels generate less power the hotter they get. So when you go down to like Arizona in the middle of July, we're actually generating more power than they are because we have about the same length of days, but we're just not as hot. And so the panels are actually performing better in the middle of December when we have 4 hours of sunlight, you know, we're not generating as much power.
Policy, what are the policy differences that make solar more popular in Minnesota?
Sure, so the first thing is in Minnesota, they have what's called net metering, which means all the power you generate in a month minus all the power you consume, they just figure out you either overgenerated and then they pay you back, or you undergenerated and you pay the difference. A state requirement is the net metering, first of all, on a monthly basis. That's the first policy, and that's a huge one, because in North Dakota, we have a five-minute policy. So what that means is every 5 minutes, they're taking a sampling, and if you're over-generating, you're selling it back to the grid, and then if you're under-generating, you're buying from the grid. So, you know, I always use the hypothetical situation of you're doing laundry in the middle of the day and it's nice and sunny out, but a cloud goes by. So now you're buying all that power from the power company and you're buying it at full retail rate. And then you finish doing your laundry and the cloud goes away. And so now you're generating way more power than you're consuming. Well, you're selling that back to the grid, but you're only selling it back at like 2 or 3 cents a kilowatt. There's this give and take where you're selling back at a lower rate and you're buying it back, and it's constant back and forth in North Dakota. In Minnesota, that doesn't happen. It's most of the co-ops in Minnesota are paying full retail rate or very near, or they'll let you actually bank those hours and use them in winter, which goes against our, you know, our discussion of winter versus summer. In Minnesota, if you generate all summer long and you're generating more power than you're using, you can use those credit hours in winter.
Where do batteries play in solar systems that you install?
That's becoming a major player in the solar market, and it's really important, especially in North Dakota, because instead of using that net metering, what we're doing is we're storing the power in batteries and then using it when you want to, so that we can kind of make sure that you get to use your own power and kind of stem that flow of buy and sell.
How long will a solar panel last, and how has the technology changed in the last 10 years, 5 years, even just a year or two ago?
Sure. So solar panels, almost every brand is now offering 25 or 30 year warranties. There's no moving parts. There's nothing really to go wrong with them. So kind of set them and forget them. For all the solar systems that we've done over the last 6 years, I've never had to go and replace a failed panel. You know, some of the other hardware, you know, maybe we'll do some tech support on
inverters, et cetera.
But the panels themselves, they just don't fail. From a technology progression standpoint, they've really kind of increased. Probably in the last 5 years, they've gone up another 25% in production. Where I was buying 300 watt panels, now I'm buying 400 watt panels for the same footprint. The other thing is that the price has really come down. It's probably at rock bottom now. And the technology is really kind of at the peak until they come out with some of the newer technologies that maybe are around the corner, but we've been hearing that for a while. So it's a really good time to get into solar because the price point is about as good as it's going to get, and the technology is about as good as it's going to get. Now where we're seeing the changes in the industry is batteries. The battery technology is going through the same progression that the solar panels did over the last 10 years. This decade is going to be the battery revolution. For residential customers, it's probably about 30% right now. I think we're going to see it going up. This comes back to regulation again. Minnesota has actually got a program right now that they're actually paying you to put batteries in if you're putting solar in. They're paying almost the full retail rate to put the batteries in. And the reason why they're doing that is it really stabilizes the grid. You adding batteries at your house you're actually doing service for the entire community because it stabilizes the grid by you not using power when there's heavy grid use. You can use your own power instead. You know, there's got to be a balance between, you know, self-generation and maintaining the power grid. You know, and I think what we're going to see is, because of the battery technologies coming forward, you're going to see a stronger, better grid as a result with distributed energy.
For a normal home, how many panels are required for a normal, let's say, I don't know, 2,300 square foot home, maybe 3 or 4 bedroom house,
sure,
a couple bathrooms, whatever. And do you usually put those on the roof or in the backyard, or is it a combination?
A typical house of that size is going to take probably somewhere between 24 and 32 panels.
How big is each panel?
Each panel is about 40 inches by 80 inches, so basically 6 feet by 3 feet, something like that, roughly. They almost always go on the roof in a residential setting. In fact, most cities have mandates that say you can't put them on the ground, so you're not putting them in the backyard. And you know, so we do almost exclusively roof mount for residential customers in town.
So it makes a difference on which way your house points.
It absolutely does. So southern facing, you're always going to get the most generation. And this also comes a little bit to your, going back to our policy discussion again. So southern facing, it's generating the most amount of power, but it's right in the center of the day, where North Dakota, because you don't use all your power in the middle of the day, maybe you are better off putting it on the east and west, generating it in the morning, you know, maybe cooling it off in the middle of the day and then generating a bunch in the evening, because that's really when you're using most of the power in your house.
And people ask you, what about the integrity of my roof? Mm-hmm. What's that going to do to, you know, how my roof performs, et cetera? What do you tell them?
Sure. I've never had a leak.
All right. We're enjoying our conversation with Ben Holson. He's a solar and renewable specialist and owner of Holson Home Automation and Solar. And let's turn the page here, an owner of an electric truck and a hybrid truck in your family.
Yep.
I don't want to go there right now. Certainly with the change in administration, the thought may be that the emphasis on electronic vehicles now may be changing. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, over the last year or year and a half, the infrastructure, especially in North Dakota, has gotten significantly better. The ability to charge in sort of at least along the interstates is now pretty common all the way across. You can get, you know, to where you need to go. We're still way behind when it comes to rural areas. I still think it would be pretty difficult to have an EV in very rural North Dakota, you know. But on the other hand, you are seeing EV car chargers pop up at all of the different car, like GM and Ford dealerships, things like that. So you do see high-speed chargers at, you know, Devil's Lake and things like that. With the change in administration, I'm very worried that we might be kind of at the peak of our infrastructure. I'm hoping it doesn't roll back. It could get interesting.
You have a hybrid in your family, and you purchased that before you purchased your all-electric vehicle. But what is the role of hybrids? My wife and I have had this discussion. My thought was, look, if we're going to get an electric vehicle, let's just get an electric vehicle, right?
Yeah.
And she's kind of hedging her bets, saying, well, what if we run out of power somewhere? We need gas or whatever.
Sure.
But what's the thinking behind the relevance of a hybrid vehicle still today?
My wife drives a plug-in hybrid, so there's a key difference between a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid, first of all. The hybrid is just electric and gas, and it kind of goes back and forth. The plug-in hybrid allows you to plug it in at night, charge it up, and you get about 30 to 40 miles on all electric before it switches over to gas. And the role in that is, vast majority of people only drive, you know, 10 or 15 miles a day.
They run to the store, they run to the office, and they come home.
Yep. Yeah. My wife, unless we go on a major trip, she puts gas in her SUV probably about once every 2 or 3 months. It's way, way, way cheaper to drive an electric vehicle or a plug-in hybrid than it is to run on gas. It costs us like probably about 60 for those 30 miles for my wife to charge her vehicle. And you just plug it in at night, and you get up in the morning, and you go, you unplug it and go. And it becomes routine. You don't even really think about it. But if you forget to plug it in, you still have the gas backup. So
I think that there are tables published about miles to the gallon conversions for EV vehicles. Is it essentially about 100, 150, 200 miles to the gallon cost-wise for fuel?
Yeah, it's something like that. It's very, very inexpensive to drive both EVs and plug-in hybrids, both for the cost per mile is just very, very low.
So like you just said, most people drive 10, 15 miles a day, if that. And it seems to me that is just perfect for the market for electric vehicles.
Yes.
Yet here in North Dakota, when I do searches, these ads come across my social media channels or whatever. Yeah, I want to look at that. What's the range? 50 miles? No. 100 miles? No. 200 miles? No. They aren't available.
Right.
They're just not here.
Yeah, so there's a lot of misinformation about full electric cars.
All right, listen. Give me the myths.
But it's cold outside. They don't work. Our governor said that. And he's a tech guy, which I just find mind-boggling that he would say something like that. My truck, I get about 315 miles in the summer. In the dead cold of winter, if I have not, you know, warmed it up or done anything like that, I'm still going to get 200, 210 miles before I need to charge. So the fact that it doesn't work, that's just not true. Another one, they can't charge in the middle of winter. I'm sure there was all the talk last year about cars waiting in line in Chicago to charge because nobody was, you know, they couldn't charge. Well, that's not what happened. That's not what's true. And the fact of the matter is, in people in North Dakota, we don't live in a giant city. We generally, you know, people that are going to be driving EVs most likely have a house, have a garage, and can charge it every single night. You know, there are obviously lots of people that live in apartments that maybe that's not true, but vast majority of people that have a house and have a garage, you plug it in at night, you don't ever have to worry about it.
Let me ask you this question. Insurance costs for electric vehicles, I've heard, never really priced it, but I've heard they're higher. And good luck if you get in a fender bender, because it's going to be a lot more expensive to repair your electric vehicle than a non-electric vehicle.
Right.
Another myth?
Yes and no. Really depends on the vehicle. My truck, yes, it's a lot more expensive if it gets hit because it's a unibody construction. That's true of all unibody construction cars. If you get in a fender bender, they have to replace like half the car. That's not because it's an electric car, it's because of the construction of the vehicle. A Tesla, they're generally really reasonable to repair, and they do that on purpose because they don't take very much markup on their parts to get their cars fixed, because they don't want broken down, dilapidated Teslas sitting around. You know, they just don't look good for the brand. So they try and keep the repair costs down as low as they can get it. So, you know, just like any other vehicle, you know, do your research, but, you know, it's not that much more compared to anything else. The other thing is that from a maintenance standpoint, there is no maintenance on an EV. Really, you change the tires, you put windshield wiper fluid in there, you don't have to change the oil, you don't have to, there's just very little maintenance.
Maybe some brakes.
Maybe some brakes once in a while, but most of the time you're not using brakes in EV because they charge the batteries when you're slowing down, so it's called one pedal braking. You let off the gas and the car slows down to a stop, and then what it's doing is it's using those electric motors as an alternator to take that energy back and put it back into the battery.
So there's more friction.
Yep, so you're not using the batteries or the brakes hardly at all.
What about batteries? We all have heard the horror stories of, oh my gosh, I'm done with the car now, my battery is going to just sit in a landfill if I can get it to a landfill forever and be a real problem for the environment.
So that's another one of those completely disingenuous, like not true lies, I guess. There's tons of precious metal in these batteries. Nobody's sending them to a landfill. There's tons of things going on with recycling of the batteries already. And I think Tesla can recycle 99% of their batteries right now, and they basically take them apart, reuse the metal, and put them right back into new batteries. So, you know, one of these things of, yes, there's rare earth metals in them, but it's not a case where we're digging it up, burning it, and then it's gone forever. These things are going to be recycled over and over and over and over again, you know, forever. So we take it out once, we use it forever.
Give our listeners a feel for acceleration. I've been in a Tesla, mm-hmm. and I know what it feels like, Ben. Yeah. I want you to tell our listeners what acceleration is like in an electric vehicle versus a non-electric vehicle.
It's pure acceleration all the way up to when you, you know, either you hit the limit or you don't. There is no power zone like you have in a gas car. So even if you're in, you know, a brand new high performance gas vehicle, you're gonna feel that sort of like acceleration zone as it switches through gears. There aren't any gears in an EV. So you hammer down the throttle, it's pure acceleration all the way until I let off the throttle. So, you know,
my advice for people is watch your neck.
Yes. Put your head against the headrest if you're gonna do that.
Because you'll feel it that way. There's the argument that buying an electric vehicle is going to harm North Dakota's and the country's petroleum industry.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because we're not using it. Maybe that's one of those things where I'll never understand an argument like that. In my view, you know, if you want to be pro-America, wouldn't you buy a vehicle where all of the power that it uses is produced right here in North Dakota? Right now, you know, my truck is mostly probably powered with coal power, but the energy is developed locally. It didn't get transported on a boat all the way across the ocean. My truck was made in Normal, Illinois. The motors were made in the U.S. The batteries were made in the U.S. This is an all-American product. All the energy that goes into it is all-American. All the energy that I use to drive around is all-American. So, you know, it's a really hard argument to make that this is anti-American or, you know, it's very pro-American to drive.
So my next question, and I want to expand on your answer here in just a moment too, but my next question has to do with, okay, everyone gets an electric vehicle, our power grid can't handle it.
Sure.
Well, I've also thought about this, Ben, that look, AI itself is going to double America's power requirements.
Yes.
That's aside from electric vehicles or anything else, and that there'll be room for fossil fuel generation of power and renewable generation of power for that fact alone.
Yes.
Okay, combo those two things together. Can our grid support many people changing to electric vehicles?
So I think that really goes back to our battery discussion, and EVs actually have a major role in that as well. And they're, you know, obviously, no matter what we do, our infrastructure needs to be upgraded all the time, right? We're constantly working on it. We're constantly using more resources and more power and stuff like that. This is just an evolution of it. What you essentially have with an EV is a rolling battery pack that doesn't necessarily need to just be used for locomotion, right? So most, the new Fords, the new Chevys, Rivian announced it. Tesla's already been doing it. They do vehicle-to-home charging, so the battery pack in the vehicle is humongous. They can push power back into the grid when needed. There's a whole industry that's just coming up where you could be charging your truck or vehicle overnight when the power is really low, and then if you weren't going to drive the 300 miles that the battery has in it, stored in it, the energy in it, you could sell that back when there's peak demand and actually make money by just using your battery as a transport of energy or a storage of energy.
Isn't there this thing with battery cycles, though, that the more cycles you use, your life shortens proportionally
there
for the battery?
There is, but that technology has gotten way better over the last 10 years, 12 years. Most Tesla battery packs now they can push, you know, 500,000, 600,000 miles. There's Teslas out there that they're saying are going to go to 1 million miles on these battery packs. So the cycles, although it is there, that constraint is getting farther and farther.
Okay, let's wind this discussion up, Ben. A year from now, towards the holiday season of 2025, you and I are going to sit down again and talk about first solar power and then electric EV vehicles again.
Yep.
What's going to be different about our discussion in 2025, first solar power?
I think I'm going to be talking about batteries being a central part of installs, especially for residential. I think what we're going to see is almost everybody's going to want them because the price has come down so significantly over the last 2 years, and it's going to continue to. I think we will be talking about tariffs that are in place at that time. Because they're coming, and that can change the market a little bit.
Are most solar panels manufactured in China?
Not in China, but they are coming out of Asia, a lot of them. We are making solar in the U.S. now. There are Canadian panels and European panels, but vast majority of them are coming out of Asia. The U.S. has really cracked down on the Chinese panels, but yeah.
Okay, electric vehicles.
I think that what we're going to be talking about is we're going to still see a progression, but we're going to see a slowdown in the push to electrify.
Ben Holson, he's a solar and renewable specialist and owner of Holson Home Automation and Solar.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great to talk to you again, Ben. Thanks for coming with us on Main Street.
Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 25th. Thanksgiving activities filled the pages of local newspapers throughout North Dakota. Details about plans, table fare, festivities, and guests at private homes were reported throughout the century, as well as Thanksgiving events at state and federal institutions. These stories often portrayed such places as a gravy train, funded by taxpayers, and human interest stories that highlighted the societal benefits of these institutions. In 1925, Warden Lee announced the Thanksgiving menu for the state penitentiary. The Bismarck Tribune reported that prisoners at the North Dakota Penitentiary would enjoy a better meal than many people outside the prison. The article stated, "Every turkey on the prison farm was expected to become a victim of Warden Lee's desire to give the men under his charge a real old-fashioned Thanksgiving dinner." The meal also included chicken, stuffing, mashed potatoes, gravy, peas, apple pie, ice cream, and treats like celery, olives, and preserves. In 1935, boys and girls at the state training school in Mandan would enjoy turkey and pumpkin pie, preceded by a chapel service. Superintendent W. McClelland said the youthful inmates could eat to their heart's content, with first aid attendants on hand in case of any issues. Mandan was the only youth correctional facility in the U.S. to offer high school classes in 1938, and one of only four in the country to house both boys and girls. Until 1947, it also served as an orphanage for children of incarcerated parents. In 1948, students at Wahpeton Indian School could choose between turkey, chicken, beef, or pork for their Thanksgiving dinner. However, Superintendent Morrison noted that the children preferred roast ham over turkey, which they ate once a week. The school's Thanksgiving festivities included a carnival, plays, music, sports, and games. Wahpeton Indian School, established in 1904, primarily served Turtle Mountain Chippewa children. The 1892 Macumber Agreement had taken their lands, leading to poverty and hardship. The school's agricultural program ended, and its land was later sold to public schools and the State School of Science. The way Thanksgiving has been celebrated reflects deeper stories of North Dakota's culture, identity, and hardship. What we celebrate today is part of a much larger, sometimes difficult history, and history is a loaded plate. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for this Monday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow, we host Kirsten Baszler. She served as North Dakota's Superintendent of Public Instruction since 2013. Now, with President Trump expressing a desire to eliminate the Department of Education, we'll ask the long-serving superintendent what that might mean to our state. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.